The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. John Hockenberry is an award-winning journalist who has reported from all over the world for a variety of news organizations, including National Public Radio, ABC News, and Dateline NBC. He is currently host of the WNYC and Public Radio International program, The Takeaway. Thank you so much for making time to chat with me.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Suzanne.
So, you know, people are certainly familiar with your work as a journalist, but I learned about one of your many interests, and I thought it would really be interesting to Sunday Baroque listeners. People don't realize, I think, that you have a very deep personal connection to music.
Well, I thought, until I got involved in the journalism business, that everybody began their career learning French Baroque harpsichord. But no, I discovered it's only me. And I stumbled onto the French Baroque doing a pretty mediocre job as a music student at the University of Oregon, a place that also started my career in journalism at an affiliate out there, a public radio station out there, KLCC. But I was at the University of Oregon Music School, and I worked very, very hard on my piano, and I even developed, because I use a wheelchair, a pedal device for pedaling a piano so that I could play the romantic literature and Chopin and some of that. And I did my recital. I played Satie's Gymnopédies and did the pedaling very, very well. But I got to the end of the whole thing, and I really, really felt like, you know, what I really wanted to do was play the piano. What I really wanted to do is to play music. I didn't want to play music and be an inventor at the same time. And my piano teacher, who is just one of the sweetest people, no longer with us, William Wood, said, you know, you should take a look at the harpsichord. And we happen to have a spectacular professor here at the University of Oregon. His name is John Hamilton. And he is still with us. He lives over in France. Just an amazingly, just an eccentric, fabulous, a fellow straight out of the Baroque. I swear, he played harpsichord, he played organ, he played flute. And I was, you know, studying the flute at that time and, of course, keyboards. And I went down with this whole attitude of like, well, the harpsichord must be some, you know, keyboard instrument that was made for people in wheelchairs because they couldn't use pedals. And of course, I know that that's not true, but that was kind of my attitude. I mean, I wasn't prepared to embrace the miracle that is harpsichord music. And John Hamilton just opened the door, and I never looked back. And, you know, to see the kind of music that was composed for the harpsichord as a way of bringing out the you know, of course, the Baroque is all about the voice, mm-hmm. you know, and the keyboard is really just sort of supporting these choral voices, whether we're talking about the viols or whether we're talking about the flutes. And the performance practice for flute is all based on Baroque trying to imitate the human voice with the way that you do your intonation and tonguing and everything on the flute. And to have that translated to the keyboard, where you really don't have dynamics, where you have to learn all of these tricks mm-hmm. to sing on the harpsichord and what notes you hold and what notes you, the whole aesthetic, the whole idea of it was just so magical to me. It was trickery. It was beauty. It was recreating these kinds of choirs that would sing to God, and it was just absolutely lusty and bawdy, because there was plenty of the medieval kicking around in Baroque music as well. And to suddenly play Bach on the harpsichord, and then to learn Couperin and Frescobaldi, this, like, you know, wild, mad Italian devil who played such unbelievable, wrote such unbelievable music in you know, fairly traditional dance idioms, but all wild stuff. And, you know, a lot of it I couldn't play, but what I tried, and particularly the Couperin, Louis Couperin was my favorite and was sort of matched by technical expertise. Francois was much more more challenging. And then just to hear the Bach that you'd heard all your life on the piano, you know, in traditional recordings, you know, the Gould recordings of you know, the Goldberg variations, mm-hmm. hearing these suddenly on the harpsichord, and to have the harpsichord like right in front of you. They had beautiful instruments, and they even made instruments in Oregon at the time. John Brumbaugh was a builder of organs, of tracker organs, based in Eugene, Oregon. He's still alive, still out there, and there were a number of harpsichord makers in town. It was a whole early music renaissance, and I was in the middle of it.
Hmm. But, you know, with that background, both in piano and harpsichord, of course, you know, there's sort of a controversy that exists over, you know, what you're supposed to use to play Baroque music, and obviously you've done both, and you've certainly heard both, but do you have your opinion on that? You want to put your two cents in on that?
Well, I was right in the middle of that argument, and at the University of Oregon at that time, and at other places, Oberlin College, other places around the United States, there was this whole, you only perform on instruments of the period, and that was a, you know, that, you know, I endorse that idea, because I think from the perspective of having been raised on piano and, you know, huge, giant, like Cleveland Symphony Orchestras, you know, large ensembles and all of the music that, you know, had double and triple parts, not the kinds of chamber orchestras that were associated with the Baroque, it was fantastic to hear the music as it would have sounded mm-hmm. at that time. But that said, there's also this counter aesthetic within the Baroque, which is, play it on anything, mm-hmm. you know, just to take the counterpoint, particularly in Baroque, with some exceptions. I mean, it's, you know, Bach is sort of the perfect example of all this, but he's not the only one. The counterpoint in Baroque means it's portable. And what, you know, you can play on a giant organ in Leipzig, you can also play on a you know, clavichord, you mm-hmm. know, in your quiet little room. And a clavichord with, you know, someone playing flute and oboe next to you. And the same, you know, four or five voices mm-hmm. have miracles to give up on different instruments. And I think, you know, when the synthesizer came in and Wendy Carlos, you know, began to play Bach on the synthesizer, as wretched as that sounded and as much as that offended people, the spirit of Bach was right in there. Because I think the idea of how it's played is less important than it is played, that it is played.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a Baroque aesthetic. And so in many ways, the argument can never be resolved. But I love to listen to, you know, traditional symphonic, you know, arrangements of Baroque pieces. And I'm, you know, I'm a Jordi Savall, you know, maniac, and mm-hmm. I love to hear the original instruments mm-hmm. and, you know, the viols and just with the perfect continuo. And, I go crazy for that stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, you jogged my memory about something. Baroque music is often called mathematical. And I thought it was kind of interesting that, if I read correctly, your first major in college was actually mathematics.
That's
that
right,
true?
And it continued to be my major, even though I had this sideline in music.
Okay, is there some connection there? You think is that legit?
Well, my connection, music and math, goes pre-Baroque. It's sort of, you know, it's more a Pythagorean kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where back in the classical period, music and math were identified as the same discipline. There was no difference between the two. And that's something mm-hmm. I discovered when I studied mathematics at the University of Chicago. And, you know, those guys were way out on other planets, you know, in algebra and differential geometry, which is what I studied at the time. And I also, you know, took some philosophy courses at USC. And they were the ones that really turned me on to the similarity of music and mathematics, and that they come out, you know, the idea of the harmonic series and the Fibonacci ratios and mm-hmm. and all the kind of universal ratios that come up in music, and you know, the harp of Orpheus is a computer, you know, and I think those ideas, I think, were very, very powerful with me. So by the time I get to Baroque and think about the mathematicalness of the, you know, progression of harmonies in, say, a fugue, you know, it seems to me we're far away from Pythagoras. But in some ways, to call Baroque music mathematical was kind of an insult, you know, when I was going to school, that everything had to have feeling and, you know, it had to make you cry or it had to, you know, attract girls like, you know, Liszt would do and Paganini would do on the violin. You know, it had to have this spirit to it. And it does have to have all of that. But but there was just this beautiful quality of a voice of something universal behind so much of the counterpoint that, you know, I just love to decipher, to figure out, to listen to, and to play.
It's so terrific to hear how passionately you talk about music. I'm going to ask you now, and I hope I know what the answer is. Do you still play?
I do still play. I don't have a harpsichord. I have a piano. I mean, a harpsichord, and you know, I've got five kids, and yeah. I mean, I would no more put a harpsichord in a room with five kids under the age of 16, you know, than I would just light it on fire. You know, they're very hard to maintain, and you know, they're very expensive. I mean, if I bought a harpsichord, my wife would, her first call would be to a lawyer. And so, you know, someday I'll maybe have an instrument, and I still have all of my music. I have all my scores and everything like that. So when I play, it's on a Bechstein baby grand piano, about a 6-footer, and that will just have to do for now. The flute, however, though, I've got a open hole flute that I can, you know, on a good day, I can do pretty well with the Bach flute partitas and some of the other great, great flute music that exists.
Do you play a modern? Do you play a modern flute or do you play Baroque flute or both?
I play a modern open hole flute. Okay. I've played a Baroque flute and I play recorder every once in a while. I have to practice up on the recorder because it's hard to find some people to play recorder with. And so, you know, I get my Baroque hits that way.
Okay. We got to have some flute talk because I am a flutist. I was a flute major, and I play.
Really?
I have a couple of Haynes flutes. What do you play?
I love to play Debussy, actually.
Oh, okay.
I can make my way through Syrinx.
Okay.
I can make my way through some of the Persichetti chamber music. I've loved there's a series of Schubert flute sonatas. He didn't write many. There's just a couple of them, and they're not hard. They're not terribly hard.
Okay.
And then you know, I love to play along with a flute is a great instrument that if you start playing it, and people are playing other music, even bluegrass.
Oh.
They always smile.
Uh-huh.
Whereas a saxophone is other wind instruments. It's a little more difficult. You can be a weapon of mass musical destruction. Not so with a flute. There's never nobody ever says no to flute.
So you mentioned a couple of favorite Baroque composers, both the Louis and François Couperin. And you also mentioned Jordi Savall as a performer you like. Who are some other, you know, composers and performers that you like? Not necessarily Baroque, but just in general, some of the music you like to listen to.
Well, I really love Bach, and I love the classics. I mean, the big ones. I mean, I love the Brandenburgs, and I just love that flute solo in Brandenburg 5. And I just, you know, every once in a while I'll put on a recording and try to play along with it, you know, that flute is just so spectacular in there, and that's more of a stunt for me. I really love the Mozart oboe ensemble, the oboe chamber music. I dreamed of playing the oboe, and I love listening to all the stuff that was written for oboe by Mozart. And I really think the oboe repertoire is, you know, hugely underplayed. And particularly from the Baroque, I mean, I think the oboe was as popular as the flute. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much great ensemble and, you know, sonata with the continuo that I love to listen to. And it's, you know, I'll put it on, you know, in giant playlists and just let it go for hours.
Mm-hmm. You know, people often will ask me what it is specifically about Baroque music that makes it appealing. You know, it seems like it's becoming very popular, and, you know, there's the big early music movement that started kind of in the middle to late 20th century, and it's just, you know, become really very mainstream in a lot of ways. I'm wondering if you have an answer to that. What do you think it is? Is there something specific about Baroque music that just has an appeal, something that reaches out and grabs you?
I think Baroque music was a period that is not unlike ours aesthetically. I think there are pulses. I wouldn't call them dance pulses, but that there are rhythmic pulses mm-hmm. that are there to allow people to play along. Mm-hmm. So what was essential for ensemble music to work is that there be a universal text, a notation that could translate. There had to be a way of kind of keeping the beat and a structure that would allow people to sort of easily fit in. And I think Baroque rhythms, I think, come from a very structured dance aesthetic, you know, that relates to like the minuet and the, you know, dances of those periods of time in the 1600s and 1700s. Mm-hmm. But they also come out of the low culture dances that were also deeply rhythmic and you know, were in some ways looked askance at by the church because way too much of the hips were moving in some of these dances. But I think in Baroque music, you get a combination of those things. And it's not unlike today. I think the way electronic music has required that people just find a beat and then sort of load on top of it mm-hmm. structures and layers of it's mostly textures in hip hop and in popular music today. But it's not that much different from the way Baroque music was constructed. You know, Bach would find a pulse and then add, you know, a theme. And then those themes would become more and more elaborate in the case of a fugue or a Pasacaglia one of the fantasies where, you know, you're kind of going crazy. Mm-hmm. But within all of that, there are samples, constant sampling of other themes, of other sort of references. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very much an aesthetic that relates to the way music is made today. Constant sort of sampling, a sense of rhythmic steadiness mm-hmm. and a layering. And I think it's no accident that Baroque music, I think, lends itself to the ears of our time. I think it didn't make much sense in the 60s where everyone is, you know, baring their souls and, you know, opening up an artery about, you know, some emotional crisis or another. And at the same time, jazz, you know, has sort of shed its pulse. And you've got, you know, free jazz and fusion music at the time. You know, at that point, Baroque was like, who would want to listen to this? It's just too boring. We've come full circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, you've got this obviously very deep knowledge and training as a musician and with a mathematics major. How did you find your way to your current career that we all know you for?
Well, I went about failing at both of those. Yes, okay. Indeed. And once I was certain that I'd failed at mathematics and music, I just volunteered at the radio station in the midst of my music and mathematics college. And it was in 1980, and I had the good fortune of experiencing the misfortune of the Mount St. Helens eruption, which was an unbelievable story in the middle of nowhere. I mean, as far as most Americans were concerned in 1980, you know, Oregon was like next to Hawaii. And you know, for people in Washington, D.C. who would call our radio station and ask if we were okay in Eugene, you know, I just say, don't these people in Washington look at maps? And, you know, and we were happy to do the story for NPR, but, you know, they would say, stay safe, you know, and we'd go, okay, we will. But it became an opportunity to file for the network, and a bunch of reporters at KLCC did very, very well there, principally Howard Berkus, who then went off to Salt Lake City, where he is to this day reporting on all kinds of things out west. He was the real pioneer. But, you know, at KLCC was, what's his name, the sports guy for Morning Edition. I can't think of his name now. I'm losing my mind. But I started freelancing out of KLCC, and it just seemed like a great way to be curious about the world. And, you know, I didn't think music would go away, but it was just such an exciting wow to go from, I have no idea what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, to, oh, let's see if we can get a story on the network. And I just sort of never turned back. But I do think that having a very general set of interests and curiosities and the experience of having acted on those is a very important ingredient for a journalist. Journalists either suffer from being know-it-alls, in which case they've ceased to be curious, or of being just way too detached. They've actually never done anything. They've just sort of shown up and watched a bunch of stuff. I think, you know, and there are plenty of great journalists who've, you know, never done anything or who are know-it-alls. I mean, they're, you know, I mean, they're fine. But I think that these are the pitfalls of journalism. And I think maintaining a sense of you have the capacity always to learn, you have the capacity always to find a new adventure around the corner. I think these are really important ingredients for storytellers to be able to remain engaged and tell people that, hey, this is important, and here's why. And I didn't necessarily think so, but I opened my mind, and I opened my eyes, and I opened my ears, and here's what I got for you. Here's the story.
Well, that's a really good point, and I think that's why you have had such an amazing and remarkable career in journalism and why we all admire you so much.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You know, I would hope that if we get together again, I will practice, and maybe we could do a duet or two.
I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for being just so interesting, and keep up this wonderful work and keep telling those stories.
All right, Suzanne. Well, it's been great talking to you, and we'll definitely meet in a musical moment.
Thank you so much.